Hey, and welcome to The Living Stone, a digital ministry from Greystone Baptist Church in Raleigh, North Carolina. On this eighth Sunday after Pentecost, Pastor Chrissy's sermon was titled, Where Do We Go From Here? Here's Sylvia Cash with our scripture reading.
The scripture today is from the book of Ruth, chapter 1, verses 1 through 22. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem of Judah went to live in the country of Moab, he and his wife and two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi, and the name of his two sons Mahlon and Chilion. They were Euphrates from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other, Ruth. When they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, so that the women were left without two sons and her husband. Then she started to return with her daughters-in-law from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had considered his people and given them food. So she set out from the place where she had been living, she and her two daughters-in-law. And they went on their way to go back to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you, as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find security, each of you, in the house of your husband." Then she kissed them, and they wept aloud. They said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Do I still have sons in my womb, that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way. For I am too old to have a husband. Even if I thought there was hope for me, even if I should have a husband tonight and bear sons, would you then wait until they were grown? Would you then refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, it has been far more bitter for me than for you, because the hand of the Lord has turned against me." Then they wept aloud again. Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. So she said, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Do not press me to leave you or to turn back from following you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. There will I be buried. May the Lord do thus and so to me and more as well, if even death parts me from you." When Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more to her. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" She said to them, "Call me no longer Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has dealt harshly with me? and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me. So Naomi returned together with Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, who came back with her from the country of Moab. They came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God.
As I'm listening to Sylvia read the first chapter of the book of Ruth and very aware of April's words a moment ago that there are no young children in the room, it seems appropriate in some ways. Because when we're really honest, there are many stories from our Bible that are probably not appropriate around children. At least if we want to protect them from the harsh realities that life brings, tragedy and pain and grief and loss. Or maybe there's some wisdom in teaching our children that life can bring harsh realities like pain and grief and trauma and loss. And maybe there's some wisdom in allowing them to hear the words from our text which speak to those more difficult moments. In many ways, today's reading from Ruth is a circular one. It begins and ends in the same place, Bethlehem. The story begins as four Israelites are forced to flee their homeland and go into a different land because of natural disaster. We're told that famine has struck. Doing what most migrant families do, Elimelech and Naomi and their two sons have to rely on their own resourcefulness and resilience and perhaps even a good measure of faith in order to survive their difficult circumstances. For them, this meant leaving Bethlehem, ironically called the breadbasket, because of famine, and traveling to Moab. Truly, there was no less desirable destination than Moab. For generations, the Israelites had separated themselves from the Moabites with both geography and narrative about how the Moabites were the descendants of Lot's incestuous acts. Because of the Israelite understanding of Moabite origins, there were laws forbidding their proximity. There were laws forbidding relationship and especially marriage between Israelites and Moabites. It's kind of strange, though, when you think about it. They had so much in common, the Israelites and the Moabites. They spoke the same language, except for they had a little bit different dialects. Their cultures were very, very similar, and they both espoused very similar religious values, even though their gods bore different names. Despite all that they had in common, however, as the Hebrew story unfolds in the Old Testament, anybody who is paying any attention at all will see that somewhere along the way, Moabite becomes synonymous with enemy. Enemy of the Hebrew people, at least, and therefore enemy of the Hebrew God, who is called Yahweh. Of course, if you come from Moab, stories might be told a little bit differently. They might be told from a different perspective, and those once very clear lines between friend and foe might grow a little bit gray. As the Hebrew story goes, that's the one that we have in our Bibles, by the way. The sons of Elimelech and Naomi, they travel to Moab and they take wives for themselves. The Hebrew word for take is the same Hebrew word that is translated as abduct in the book of Judges. And so it makes me wonder what kind of marital situation brought Ruth and Orpah into this story to begin with. It makes me grateful that some of our children are not in the room. Then, as quickly as we wrap our minds around the plot that is unfolding, all the male characters in the story seem to die, leaving the three women full of grief, pain, trauma, and loss to once again rally and make their own way forward. If the author were to pause here and ask the question, where does it hurt? We might be in for a longer story today. I suppose, though, that Naomi would have cried out in unbearable pain, the pain of losing her sons, a grief that no parent should ever know. And in the wake of her husband's death, also, the layers of compounding pain would be enough to send any of us into deepest despair, would it not? And perhaps Orpah, if asked the question, where does it hurt? She might say that she is still reeling from the pain of being taken from her home to be wed into an Israelite family. The trauma and shock of something like that doesn't just go away overnight or over the course of a few years. Maybe for her, the loss of her husband was painful, yes, but also strangely liberating, perhaps. And maybe the combination of those two different kinds of grief ushered in something altogether unique that could not be understood by anybody else around her, save for maybe Ruth. Maybe Ruth was feeling the same way as Orpah. After all, they shared the same experience of takenness. But somehow for Ruth, in her trauma, pain, and grief, she responds differently and decides to stay with Naomi despite Naomi's attempts to send her back to her homeland. It's amazing, isn't it? Three different women, three different stories, three different responses. Pain and grief and trauma and loss can do some crazy things. They can make us send everybody away because we just want to be alone. They can make us say that we just want to be alone when all we really want is somebody who can handle the raw emotions we might be feeling. Somebody who can handle it without trying to fix it, to tidy up our grief and make it a little more presentable or palpable. Somebody who can sit with us in the middle of our darkest night and not proclaim that there is light on the horizon, but rather somebody who can sit with us and recognize the darkness and remind us that we are not alone. Sometimes when pain, grief, trauma, and loss all compound together in our lives, like they were for each of the women in today's story, there is no right answer. Sometimes one size fits all doesn't fit anybody. One scholar points out that when Naomi urges the Moabite women, Ruth and Orpah, to leave her and to return to their homes, Orpah accepts that gift and departs the scene. Here's the key: without condemnation. While we continue to follow the story as it unfolds between Ruth and Naomi, sometimes we fail to remember that Orpah's departure is not criticized. Perhaps what she needed was to leave, to walk away, to go home, and to start again. And despite the opportunity to criticize, to call her out, to say that she had done the wrong thing, the text doesn't do it. As the story unfolds, Ruth somehow sees through Naomi's grief. She sees through her grief-filled words, and she decides to stay put. She didn't accept what Naomi needed was to be alone, despite what Naomi was saying. Ruth would not accept it, and she made up her mind for herself that she was going to stick with her mother-in-law. Maybe Ruth stayed out of generosity and compassion with Naomi. Maybe the two had developed a good and healthy relationship over those 10 years. Maybe Ruth was worried about Naomi an older, widowed, and now childless woman. How was she to survive in the ancient world? Maybe Ruth was worried, and maybe she stayed out of concern for her mother-in-law. Or maybe Ruth could see that what Naomi really needed was exactly the same thing that Ruth herself really needed: friendship. Together, the two women form a relationship that defies all social expectation. Born out of the compounding layers of devastation, they discover a shared humanity that is stronger than the stories and assumptions and prejudices that they have been taught to harbor for one another. Together, they accept what is, and they choose friendship over expectation. By this time, Naomi had heard that the famine in Bethlehem was over, and she is returning to her homeland. Now, at that point, it would have been easier for her to return home without Ruth, the Moabite. You may remember from the reading the kind of reception she got. And it probably would have been easier for Ruth to return to Moab, where her family probably was, where she would not face the multiple marginalizations of sexism and racism and prejudice and cultural difference. By all worldly measures, the two would have fared better alone. But that is not what they needed. Somewhere, it seems, in the midst of all of their pain, they realized what they needed was not to return home alone, but to stick together. For two people who had suffered so much, to have that kind of realization is pretty amazing in just about any circumstance. Grief and pain tend to drive us apart more often than bond us together. So often our raw feelings and emotions wear the masks of arrogance and pride and defensiveness and anger, each one just driving a wedge between us and everyone around us, even those who are part of our family, even those who should understand us. We cry out, "Go away, leave me alone." And we sound a lot like Naomi, don't we? But good thing Ruth doesn't follow directions. She didn't do as Naomi demanded, even though it probably would have been the most comfortable option for both of them. Instead, Ruth decides to stay close, to draw near to Naomi in a relationship of committed mutuality. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Your fate will be my fate. We will share it together. This kind of dedication would be impressive if they were coming from the same place, if their stories were similar, if they'd seen one another as equals before tragedy struck. But knowing what we know about how the Israelites and the Moabites got along, how they saw one another, this gesture of love and commitment and mutuality is downright miraculous. Ruth comes from a people who were marginalized, ostracized, and dehumanized by Naomi's people for generations. It's all they knew. And here was Ruth, just a few steps away from freedom, choosing instead solidarity and mutuality. Here she chooses a fate, a future that would be irrevocably tied up with Naomi's. How did she know that is what was needed? Greg Jarrell is one of the founders of an intentional community on the west side of Charlotte. It's called the QC Family Tree. QC, of course, being short for the Queen City. QC Family Tree. Greg is also a top-notch theologian, preacher, activist, saxophone player, and as it turns out, Greg is also a phenomenal writer. He has a new book out called A Riff of Love, in which he weaves together the principles of jazz music, riff, jam session, blues, etc., with the realities of living with commitment and mutuality in his neighborhood named Enderley Park. After moving to that neighborhood in 2005, after graduating from seminary, Greg and his wife Helms slowly and intentionally began building relationships with the folks who already lived there by hosting dinners at their house twice a month, allowing neighbors to use their laundry machines. Everybody was invited, the door was open, and everybody knew it. With time and hospitality and lots of deep listening, the Gerald family has become part of the fabric of Enderley Park. They host a youth group, they have summer interns, they grow a community garden, they teach art and pottery classes, they go on field trips, they even host a freedom school in the summertime, and all the time they advocate for fair housing practices in Charlotte, the most urgent issue facing their neighbors as the city continues to grow and land grabs become more and more prominent, making these people vulnerable to displacement all the time. Greg and his family constantly invest their own resources into the neighborhood. They offer food and friendship, and they embody their faith in Enderley Park day after day after day. In the book, A Riff of Love, Greg tells a painful story about a young man who was shot and killed on a corner near their house. As the neighbors learned about Khalil's death, they decide to host a vigil on the steps of an abandoned church that sits in plain view of the place where the shooting occurred. The irony of the abandoned church and the violence not lost on Greg. Greg was asked to lead the vigil, and without posting a formal announcement or making flyers to display the time and the place, everybody seemed to know when and where. And so they gathered. Word got around really quickly, and there were so many in attendance that all the sidewalks began to overflow as people spilled into the streets and then across to the next block. Everybody had come to mourn and to grieve and to remember together. Several neighbors participated in the vigil along with Greg. A young woman sang songs through her tears, beautiful notes of pain and loss pouring out of her lips with a song. Others spoke, telling stories and offering words of support to the young man's family. The children in the neighborhood wrote little messages on pieces of paper and tied them to balloons to be released into the air, carrying unspoken prayers straight up to God in heaven with hopes that something might change. The crowd in the neighborhood reached a size that it began to interrupt traffic flow and slow down the movement of cars on a main thoroughfare. And because of that, the media began to gather. Something was happening here. At some point during the vigil, Greg noticed a small disturbance way in the back of the crowd, and it was quickly broken up by neighbors who have a way of self-correcting, Greg says. It happened so quickly that many probably didn't even notice it happened. The only reason Greg saw it is because he was standing in front of the crowd and he could see it all. He didn't think much about it. And he later learned that the two guys who'd come to bear witness to the pain and the grief and the trauma and loss of their friend's death, they just had their tempers flare up. We can understand that, can't we? Greg describes that event this way in his book. This hardly seems unusual. Packed tightly into a small space and experiencing trauma unlike Enderley Park had experienced for many years, if ever, a couple of guys got overheated. In a testimony to the resilience of the gathered community, the potential for large conflict was quickly resolved by another neighbor. Brother Keith gathered them in. A young man himself, barely over 20, he had the wisdom to offer them another way to express their rage. He helped them, and he helped to create a comfort by offering some extra space and a listening ear. He held his huge arm around one of the young men, and he welcomed him into a safe place to let go of some of that grief. Later that night, Greg turned on the news to find the whole neighborhood gathering. All the work, all the tears, all the energy, all the grief, all the beauty of the day's events was buried under a lead that said this: troubled neighborhood spills over into violence at vigil for peace. Greg says, the reporter saw what he was conditioned to see. His eyes were trained to see trouble on our side of town, and so that is what he saw. The unfortunate thing is that the viewers also saw then what our eyes are conditioned to see. And it reinforced all that we, the viewers, are thinking we already knew. The inner city is the place of perpetual crisis, a place of constant danger. Without any sense of holy curiosity or creativity, we, like the reporter and the local audience, allow ourselves to remain satisfied with the narratives that we have been taught about us and them. Don't drive through that part of town at night. That neighborhood isn't safe. You really don't want to live over there. I wouldn't want my kids to go to that school. I don't know about you. Those people are violent, they are lazy, unmotivated, fill in the blank with all the things we have been taught about them. But as I read Greg's book this week, and as I read the story of Ruth, and I sat with that ancient narrative about Israelites and Moabites, literally on opposite sides of the ancient tracks, I couldn't help but notice that Ruth herself came from a troubled neighborhood, at least according to the Hebrew tradition, which, let us not forget, is our tradition as well. We are descendants of Naomi's people. Ours are the stories that rejected the Moabites, labeling them as perpetual other, outsider, unworthy, dirty, uncivilized, unmotivated, unwelcome, prone to violence, not the kind of people we want our children to hang around with. Isn't it ironic that Ruth, from Moab, becomes the ancestor of David, the great king of Israel? Isn't it ironic that through that same line, Ruth from Moab becomes the ancestor of Jesus, our Savior and our Redeemer? Isn't it ironic that through Ruth from Moab, we learn that what is needed is hesed, loving kindness, poured out in relationship? Could it be that the only way to loving kindness, to selfless, godly, and Christ-like love is through curiosity, through listening, through understanding, and an unwavering commitment to living life together, no matter which side of the tracks, so to speak, we come from? Could it be that the only way to loving kindness is through a commitment to a shared mutuality? Whether we are from Northwest Raleigh or Southeast Raleigh, whether we are rich or poor, Israelite or Moabite, black or white, Jew or Gentile, Christian or Muslim, gay or straight, what if hesed is only possible when we learn to seek after it together? With a stubborn commitment that understands that despite all appearances and narratives to the contrary, we really are all connected. Could it be that Martin Luther King Jr. had it right when he wrote his letter from a cell in a Birmingham jail, saying, In a real sense, all life is interrelated. We are all caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be, and you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. This is the interrelated structure of our reality. Sometimes it's easier to see in hindsight, though. But in this moment, could it be that it isn't so important where we go from here? I know that's the question of the day, but could it be that it's not so important where we are going? You know, today's story does begin and end in Bethlehem. It's circular. It really didn't go anywhere. Could it be that it is not so important where we are going, but that we go together? Could it be that it's not so important where we go, but that we go together and with a sense of curiosity that allows us to ask questions about our neighbors rather than just jumping to our own conclusions built on the stories that we have been told about why they are the way that they are and why they can't get themselves out of those undesirable circumstances? Could it be that our salvation, or at least a piece of it, is still held in the womb of Ruth? From Moab, a perpetual outsider, mother of David, mother of Jesus, mother of Judaism, and mother of Christianity, could it be that we need to close our eyes because they resemble the eyes of the reporter who could only see trouble in the troubled neighborhood? And if we close our eyes, could we open our hearts to the God who is trying to liberate us even now from all the prejudice that we carry with us? Maybe God is trying to liberate us through relationships that look and feel more like the kingdom of heaven than the kingdom of this world. And what if that kingdom is breaking in even now with questions rather than answers? Questions that sound like, where do you come from? Where does it hurt? What do you need? Questions that start with words like you and I and end with words like we. Where are we going from here? Can we go together? And if we are able to be transformed from I and you to we and us, it would be a miracle. And as that miracle occurs, we might just discover that together, the where will take care of itself. Whether it's Moab or Bethlehem doesn't really matter. What matters is that we're going together, all of us, with curiosity, with patience and grace for one another, and with joy, but most importantly, with love. I want to leave you with a poem written by Reverend Sarah R., who crafted the series built on questions that we have been learning from for the past several weeks. It's called Flashlight. I wish I could draw you a map of the next steps, the next conversation, the next brave truth, the next fumble, the next apology. Wouldn't it be nice to know what's coming? Wouldn't it be nice to be able to prepare our hearts? But I don't know where to go from here. I'm a child with a flashlight, deeply hopeful, and a little bit nervous, all at the very same time. But what I do know is I don't want to go anywhere without you. So I am hoping that you will take my hand and see this truth. Trust my voice. Look for the good, and day by day we can go from here because we were never meant to go alone. And maybe we'll get lost. But then again, maybe we will be found. So if you're willing, if you'll just say yes, I will let you hold the flashlight. And we can find our way, step by step, light in hand, abolishing shadows together. Who needs a map when you have the Christ light anyway?